Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, August the 23rd, 2021. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with Richard Hurley. Since the big news this past week has all been about events in Afghanistan, I thought we would devote this evening's show to the subject of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, the war, and how it's ending. There are obviously many angles to discuss, but one thing we'll cover, among others, is the lesson learned report that was just issued earlier this month by the United States Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Has some interesting insights. But first, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you?
Good.
And good evening, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well in light of the COVID concerns that continue to plague us these days. I want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show, and we welcome your views, your comments. So pick up the phone and give us a ring. There's plenty of time to discuss anything that may be on your mind with regard to maybe it's Afghanistan or the VA. But please do that. That phone number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. And now let's go back to David.
Rick, thanks. Like I say, we want to talk about Afghanistan. It's just shocking, I think, to everyone how quickly the Afghan army and the Afghan government that we had basically trained and set up and funded and supported over the last 20 years just collapsed, melted away, disappeared, vaporized. Whatever happened to them is just mind-boggling. And now the Taliban, who we had thrown out of power in late 2001 because they were sheltering al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, who, by the way, had escaped over into Pakistan, but that's another problem. You know, how could that happen? How could this entire thing fall like a house of cards? And many people were making the analogy to Vietnam. Those of you that may be old enough to remember the end of the Vietnam War, maybe you've just read about it recently in the comparisons between the end of Afghanistan and the Vietnam War. But Vietnam, you know, that was a long war, not as long as Afghanistan. And during the Nixon administration, January 69, his first term, Nixon and Kissinger and others were trying to gradually draw down U.S. troops and negotiate with North Vietnam. And by latter part of 72, they'd reached an agreement. Treaty was signed in January 73. The U.S. forces were out. Our POWs were returned February, March of 73. And we pretty much left. And the South Vietnamese military took over, as they should have been. They held on for 2 years. My point being, look at the Afghan army, which was many times the size of the Taliban. They just folded in essentially 1 week. And mostly over just one weekend. It's just amazing. And what lessons should we draw from that? What lessons should we draw from the experience of the fact that this has taken 20 years of U.S. Very costly investment in lives and other resources and the consequences that really worldwide because of this? What lessons should be drawn from that? Many people are focusing on just how poorly this evacuation has taken place. You know, a few weeks ago, the news reported that our forces had left a major air base there. I think it was Bagram Air Base, and turned out the lights. And they left in the middle of the night, and our Afghan allies couldn't even figure out how to turn the power back on. It was pathetic. And one of the NBC correspondents was literally riding his bicycle across the tarmac of the air base to show you how anyone could pretty much access it, and it was a ghost town. And And now we see just a couple weeks later this complete chaos in the Capitol and people trying to get out of Dodge, and really don't know what's going to unfold from here. But again, as I say, the shocking thing is just how the several hundred thousand Afghan army troops that we had trained and resourced just folded, you know, got out of their uniforms, went back into civilian life, and melted away. I suspect we'll probably never know how many of them were truly Taliban people. I was talking to a Vietnam War veteran earlier today. He had served a year, 13 months, as a Marine in the northern part of South Vietnam, and we were discussing sort of a comparison between Vietnam and here, and just both wondering, you know, how many of these Taliban soldiers you see walking around in U.S. uniforms have been people that really, you know, had fooled us that we'd been training and resourcing for all these years. He said the same problem was over in Vietnam. He said you could never really tell in many situations who was the VC, the Viet Cong versus South Vietnamese. But at least in Vietnam, South Vietnam held on for 2 years after we left, and not 2 days. So it's there's a lot we can talk about, and I encourage our listeners, if there's anyone that wants to chime in with their thoughts or opinions or observations or insight, like Rick said, our toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. Before I turn it over to Rick Hurley again, I want to sort of introduce one thing I want to talk about tonight. Back in 2008, Congress created an independent agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. The acronym is SIGAR, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. And some people call it by its acronym SIGAR or SIGAR. It was created by Congress 2008. It was supposed to focus on the Afghanistan mission by the United States and reconstruction issues, provide some oversight. The current special IG is a guy named John Sopko. He took over in 2012 as the Special Inspector General. Mr. Sopko has more than 30 years of experience in oversight investigations as a prosecutor, congressional counsel, senior federal government advisor. And unlike most inspector generals, you know, those of us that served in the military are quite familiar with IGs. IGs at every level of the military, from base level through middle commands to higher commands, the defense departments, and IGs play a really important role in oversight and making sure that things are done right and the military is ready. But in this situation, the IG for Afghanistan Reconstruction had jurisdiction over all programs and operations supported by U.S. reconstruction dollars over the last 20 years, regardless of what agency was involved. It wasn't just a narrow silo, basically. It had the authority to look over the entire $145 billion reconstruction effort. So it was uniquely positioned to identify and address, you know, across the government lessons. Back in late 2014, the IG started its Lesson Learned program. Lesson Learned is a big buzzword, you know, that we use in the military, after action reports, those sorts of things. But the former commanding general of the U.S. and NATO troops, General John Allen, had recommended it, along with the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, and other officials. And they alerted, you know, officials on the need for some comprehensive review of the U.S. efforts there to improve those efforts, but also efforts in the future. So what the IG has done and released this I think it was a little more than a week ago, this Lesson Learned report, which is the timing is quite interesting when you see how quickly things folded. But anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Hurley, who's going to introduce the main lessons from the IG's report, and then we'll go from there. Rick.
Hey, David. Yeah, and before I do that, you know, I was listening to you, and, you know, I was wondering, you know, the difference between, possibly one of the differences between what happened in Vietnam and what happened in Afghanistan is, I don't think the president of South Vietnam walked away from his office.
You know, right,
President of Afghanistan just, I mean, he was gone. I mean,
yeah.
It was, you know, think about that. If you're and let's take an Afghan soldier who's not affiliated with Taliban or, you know, there's not that part of that he's an Afghan soldier and he's trying to do the right thing. And then he learns that his leader has just left.
For another country.
For another country. I mean, what's the message? You know, and I just, you know, I guess I've been thinking about that. And before, you know, I know we're going to get into this, but I just wonder what intel were we getting over the last 20 years that could have possibly given us any sort of direction that that leader would be that weak. I don't know the answer to that, obviously. But
right.
obviously we didn't realize how weak he was, or chicken.
What's amazing is Hamid Karzai, who was the president that we had propped up for a long time, somewhat controversial. I think there are allegations of corruption in his family. But he stuck around. He stayed in Afghanistan. He's reaching out to the Taliban, which also makes you wonder, what was really going on beneath the surface that U.S. officials were either totally clueless about or just turned a blind eye to, which is that, whatever people like Karzai, whatever your typical Afghan soldier was doing, they were just biding their time for us to get out. You know, they had no intention of buying into any of whatever we were trying to do.
I mean, we didn't even let the Afghanistans at the negotiation table when we sat down with the Taliban.
That's bizarre.
The United States and the Taliban. And Afghanistan's just sitting out there like, okay, what? Knocking on the door, you guys finished yet? You know? And the guy that negotiated for the Taliban was sitting in a prison.
Yeah.
You know, the United States asked to have that guy released so he could sit there and negotiate the treaty or the agreement. I mean, it's just bizarre. Anyway, history will have its day with what happened in Afghanistan, that's for sure. So here are the main lessons from the IG's report, which was just released earlier this month. First, I'll list the lessons. Then we'll go over each in more detail. We will be mainly directly quoting from the report itself. Number one, as far as strategy, the U.S. government continuously struggled to develop and implement a coherent strategy for what it hoped to achieve. Number two, as far as timeliness, the U.S. government consistently underestimated the amount of time required to rebuild Afghanistan and created unrealistic timelines and expectations that prioritize spending quickly. These choices increase corruption and reduce the effectiveness of programs. In terms of sustainability, many of the institutions and infrastructure projects the United States built were not sustainable in the long term. Regarding personal involvement, counterproductive civilian and military personal policies and practices thwarted the effort. Number five, regarding security, or actually the last of security from violence, persistent insecurities severely undermine reconstruction efforts. As far as the context of its efforts, the U.S. government did not understand the Afghan social, economic, and political dynamics and therefore failed to tailor its efforts accordingly. Number seven, as far as the need for monitoring and evaluation, the U.S. government agencies rarely conducted sufficient monitoring and evaluation to understand the impact of their efforts. Okay, David, back to you.
Okay, let's talk about each one of these lessons from the Special IG for Afghanistan Reconstruction. First, I'd like to remind our listeners, we have a nationwide toll-free call-in number, 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. Feel free to call in and offer your thoughts on what's happened in Afghanistan over the last 10 days or so, the collapse of the government, takeover by the Taliban, what lessons the United States should be learning, what questions should be asked. You know, I listened to Rick the other day, and I think you had mentioned you had listen to Professor Andrew Bacevich, also retired Army Colonel, that we had interviewed back in 2018 for our film on the cost of war. And I listened to a couple of interviews. He's been on a lot of interviews over the last week, and I think one of his main themes is to get people to make sure that that they ask questions beyond simply the obvious one. The obvious one is, how did we manage to screw up the departure, you know, with the chaos we've seen in the last 10 days? The more important questions would be, you know, why did we get involved in Afghanistan in the manner that we did from the beginning? You know, from the very beginning when we're going after bin Laden, and the manner in which we outsourced, instead of using our special forces, we outsourced it to some of the tribal leaders. And what do you think happened? Bin Laden escaped over into Pakistan. We didn't know where he went. We knew he had escaped. And then we then turned after we threw the Taliban out of power, we turned into the nation-building thing, which, ironically, go back and listen to the 2000 presidential debates between George W. Bush and Al Gore. And George W. Bush is talking about how he's never going to get involved in nation-building as president. Well, how ironic, you know. A year after those debates, that's exactly what they start doing. But anyway, let's talk about these seven lessons from the IG, and the very first one deals with, you know, the big picture, the strategy issue. The U.S. government continuously struggled to achieve, to develop and implement a coherent strategy. The United States government has now spent 20 years and $145 billion trying to rebuild Afghanistan, its security forces, its civilian government institutions, its economy, and its civil society. Now, that's in addition to the Defense Department, which has spent at least $837 billion on war fighting, during which over 2,400 American troops were killed, over 1,100 Allied troops were killed, and over 20,000 U.S. troops that were injured. The Afghans have taken an even greater toll. At least 66,000 Afghan troops have been killed, more than 48,000 Afghan civilians have been killed, and at least 75,000 have been injured since 2001. According to the IG report admits that those numbers are likely significant underestimations, and I would certainly agree with that. If you go to other studies, such as the Cost of War Project, sponsored by Brown University's website, costofwar.org, they do a much more in-depth, deeper analysis of the human costs, which include not just those people that are killed directly in a combat situation, but those that have died because of the loss of infrastructure, the loss of health care, just the destroyed economy, having to become refugees, and also, you know, the millions of people that have had to flee Afghanistan, some of whom returned over the years, but they fled. Where do they flee to? Places like Iran, places like Pakistan, places in Europe, some of the United States. So there's been a huge human toll. Now, all these costs were meant to serve a purpose, and this is what the IG points out in its lesson learned. That definition of purpose has evolved over time. At various times, the U.S. government hoped to, number one, eliminate al-Qaeda, which was hiding under the Taliban regime, then also to decimate the Taliban movement that hosted al-Qaeda, then to deny all terrorist groups a safe haven in Afghanistan, then to build Afghan security forces so they could deny terrorists a safe haven in the future, and then help the civilian government become legitimate and capable enough to win the trust of Afghans. Each of those goals, once accomplished, was thought to move the U.S. government one step closer to being able to depart. According to the IG report, while there have been several areas of improvement, most notably in the areas of health care, maternal health, and education, the progress has been elusive, and the prospects for sustaining this progress are dubious. And now we see, you know, just a few weeks after this report, what that really means. The U.S. government has been often overwhelmed by the magnitude of rebuilding a country that at the time of the U.S. invasion in 2001 had already seen two decades of Soviet occupation, then civil war, and then Taliban brutality. Since its founding in 2008, the Special IG for Afghanistan Reconstruction has tried to make U.S. government's reconstruction more likely to succeed. That was part of its purpose. The IG's investigations held criminals accountable for defrauding the U.S. government. And as a side note, you go to the website, sigar.mil, and you can read the dozens and dozens of IG reports of what they've done, with their, including, you'd be surprised, or maybe you want to be surprised, at the amount and the type of fraud perpetrated, not just by American contractors, but by Afghans and others. So the IG's report identified various weaknesses. Their quarterly reports provided near real-time analysis of the reconstruction problems as they unfolded over the years. And the IG's lesson learned report identified challenges that threatened the viability of that. This is sort of the background to this. They conducted many interviews, reviewed lots of documents, and then they've reached these seven lessons. So, Rick, I'll let you take it a little further here in talking about the first lesson regarding strategy.
Let's go to lesson one concerning the strategy. The U.S. government continuously struggled to develop and implement a coherent strategy for what it hoped to achieve. The challenges U.S. officials faced in creating long-term sustainable improvements raise questions about the inability of U.S. government agencies to devise, implement, and evaluate reconstruction strategies. The division of responsibilities among agencies did not always take into account each agency's strengths and weaknesses. For example, the Department of State is supposed to lead reconstruction efforts, but it lacked the expertise and resources to take the lead and own the strategy in Afghanistan. In contrast, DOD has the necessary resources and expertise to manage strategies, but not for large-scale reconstruction missions with significant economic and governance components. This meant no single agency had the necessary mindset, expertise, and resources to develop and manage the strategy to rebuild Afghanistan. For the U.S. government to successfully rebuild a country, especially one still experiencing violent conflict, civilian agencies will need the necessary resources and flexibility to lead in practice, not just on paper. This poor division of labor resulted in weak strategy. While initially tied to the destruction of Al-Qaeda, the strategy grew considerably to include the defeat of the Taliban, an insurgent group deeply entrenched in Afghan communities, then expanded again to include corrupt Afghan officials who undermined U.S. efforts at every turn. Meanwhile, deteriorating security compelled the mission to grow even further in scope. U.S. officials believed the solution to insecurity was pouring ever more resources into Afghan institutions, but the absence of progress after the surge of civilian and military assistance between 2009 and 2011 made it clear that the fundamental problems were unlikely to be addressed by changing resource levels. The U.S. government was simply not equipped to undertake something this ambitious in such an uncompromising environment, no matter the budget. After a decade of escalation, the United States began a gradual decay, long drawn down, that steadily revealed how dependent and vulnerable the Afghan government remains. David, how about lesson two?
Okay, the second lesson from the IG involved timelines. The U.S. government consistently underestimated the amount of time required to rebuild Afghanistan and created unrealistic timelines and expectations that prioritized spending money quickly. These choices increased corruption and reduced the effectiveness of programs. According to the IG's report, the U.S. reconstruction effort in Afghanistan could be described as 21-year reconstruction efforts rather than one 20-year effort. Let me repeat that. It could be described as 20 individual one-year reconstruction efforts instead of one comprehensive 20-year effort. U.S. officials often underestimated the time and resources needed to rebuild Afghanistan, leading to short-term solutions like the surge of troops, money, and resources from 2009 to 2011. U.S. officials also prioritized their own political preferences for what they wanted reconstruction to look like, rather than what they could realistically achieve, given the constraints and conditions on the ground. Early in the war, U.S. officials denied mission resources necessary to have an impact, and implicit deadlines made the task even harder. As security deteriorated and demands on donors increased, so did pressure. U.S. officials created explicit timelines in the mistaken belief that a decision in Washington could transform the calculus of complex Afghan institutions, power brokers, and communities contested by the Taliban. So by design, these timelines often ignored conditions on the ground and forced reckless compromises in U.S. programs, creating perverse incentives to spend money quickly and focus on short-term, unsustainable goals that could not create the conditions to allow a victorious U.S. withdrawal. Rather than reform and improve, Afghan institutions and power brokers found ways to co-opt the funds for their own purposes, i.e., they stole the money, folks, which only worsened the problems these programs were meant to address. When U.S. officials eventually recognized this dynamic, they simply found new ways to ignore conditions on the ground. Troops and resources continued to draw down in full view of the Afghan government's inability to address instability or prevent it from worsening. And we're seeing this in the complete collapse of the government. Okay, Rick, the third lesson, dealing with sustainability.
Yes, lesson three, sustainability. Many of the institutions and infrastructure projects the United States built were not sustainable. Reconstruction programs are not like humanitarian aid. They are not meant to provide temporary relief. Instead, they serve as a foundation for building the necessary institutions of government, civil society, and commerce to sustain the country indefinitely. Every mile of road the United States built and every government employee it trained was thought to serve as a springboard for even more improvements and to enable the reconstruction effort to eventually end. However, the U.S. government often failed to ensure its projects were sustainable over the long term. Billions of reconstruction dollars were wasted as projects went unused or fell into disrepair. Demands to make fast progress incentivized U.S. officials to identify and implement short-term projects with little consideration for host government capacity and long-term sustainability. U.S. agencies were seldom judged by their projects' continued utility, but by the number of projects completed and dollars spent. Over time, U.S. policies emphasized that all U.S. reconstruction projects must be sustainable, but Afghans often lacked the capacity to take responsibility for projects. In response, the U.S. government tried to help Afghan institutions build their capacity, but those institutions often could not keep up with U.S. demands for fast progress. Moreover, pervasive corruption put U.S. funds sent through the Afghan government at risk of waste, fraud, and abuse. These dynamics motivated U.S. officials to provide most assistance outside Afghan government channels. While expedient, the approach meant that Afghan officials were not getting experience in managing and sustaining U.S. construction projects over the long term. As a result, even when programs were able to achieve short-term success, they often could not last because the Afghans, who would eventually take responsibility for them, were poorly equipped, trained, or motivated to do so. David, lesson four.
Yeah, and before we do that, I just want to touch on something that you had mentioned, Rick, about the United States government trying to help Afghan institutions build their capacity. But I think it's probably a misuse of the term institutions to describe what a third world, impoverished, completely corrupt, narcotic, exporting country Afghanistan was. You know what I mean? It's not like we were helping, mm-hmm. that you really call those institutions. It was it was the country was a mess. It also happened to be called the, you know, the graveyard of empires. British, Russian, now the United States have lost over the last couple hundred years in Afghanistan. And by comparison, and I'm going to get to lesson four in a second. You know, we've been in Afghanistan for 20 years, and it's hardly any better off now. It isn't, and maybe in small ways, then, but it's not going to last. Compare, for example, World War II and the nations of Germany and Japan that we came close to just wiping off the map. I mean, we firebombed and bombed all of Japan, and what we didn't firebomb, we dropped two nuclear bombs on. Okay, we completely destroyed that nation, 1945. By the mid-60s, 20 years later, again, the same time that we've been in Afghanistan, the Japanese economy and culture is completely rebuilt, and now they're competing with us by outselling us with automobiles. I mean, that's in the same time that we've been in Afghanistan. So it's not just a matter of the United States government not knowing what it was doing in Afghanistan, which is, I think, a completely true observation. But the United States was completely ignorant of the context of what we were dealing with in Afghanistan. So let me go to lesson number four from the IG. And this deals with personnel. The conclusion is counterproductive civilian and military personnel policies and practices thwarted the reconstruction effort. According to the IG, and I'm quoting from the report, it says the United States government's inability to get the right people into the right jobs at the right times was one of the most significant failures of the reconstruction mission. It is also one of the hardest to repair. U.S. personnel in Afghanistan were often unqualified and poorly trained, and those who were qualified were difficult to retain. I mean, after all, who'd want to stay around there for longer than a year? I'm quoting directly from the report here. DOD police advisors watched American TV shows to learn about policing. Civil affairs teams were mass-produced via PowerPoint presentations, and every agency experienced annual lobotomies as staff constantly rotated out, leaving successors to start from scratch and make similar mistakes all over again, unquote. That's from the IG's report. That's the IG's report, not mine, to say that the agencies were essentially experiencing an annual lobotomy. They lost all their collective insight and expertise because of staff rotation. So remember what I said earlier. You look at the Afghanistan Reconstruction Program as not one 20-year effort, but 20 individual one-year programs with very little continuity. Okay, continue quoting from the report. It says, these dynamics had direct effects on the quality of reconstruction. There were often not enough staff to oversee the spending and certainly not enough who were qualified to do so. This was particularly true for civilian agencies such as State Department or the U.S. Agency for International Development, which should have been leading the effort but were unable to meaningfully perform that role. This compelled the better resourced DOD to fill the void, creating tensions with civilian agencies that often had different ideas but fewer staff to offer. And again, what's the purpose of the DOD? Hey, folks, as people that, you know, serve, you know it's to kill people and break things. That's really the mission of the Defense Department. They are not in the business of building things. They've been put in that position, but really they're not. So what do you expect whenever the DOD ends up being the, you know, the better resourced and better equipped organization? Okay, Rick, let's go to the fifth lesson from the IG.
Insecurity. Persistent insecurity severely undermined reconstruction efforts. The absence of violence was a critical precondition for everything U.S. officials tried to do in Afghanistan, yet the U.S. effort to rebuild the country took place while it was being torn apart. For example, helping Afghans develop a credible electoral process became ever more difficult as insecurity across the country steadily worsened, intimidating voters, preventing voter registration, and closing polling stations on election day. In remote areas where the Taliban contested control, U.S. officials were unable to make sufficient gains to convince frightened rural Afghans of the benefits of supporting their government. Insecurity and the uncertainty that it spawns have also made Afghanistan one of the worst environments in the world to run a business. The long-term development of Afghanistan's security forces likewise saw a number of harmful compromises driven by the immediate need to address rising insecurity. The danger meant that even programs to reintegrate former fighters faltered, as ex-combatants could not be protected from retaliation if they rejoin their communities. Wow. All right, David, over to you. Context.
Okay, here's the sixth lesson from the Special IG for Afghanistan Reconstruction, and it's this, and I quote, "The United States government did not understand the Afghan context and therefore failed to tailor its efforts accordingly," unquote. Effectively, rebuilding Afghanistan required a detailed understanding of the country's social, economic, and political dynamics. However, U.S. officials were consistently operating in the dark, often because of the difficulty of collecting the necessary information. The U.S. government also clumsily forced Western technocratic models onto Afghan economic institutions. That's a quote from the report. U.S. officials trained security forces in advanced weapon systems they could not understand, much less maintain. They imposed formal rule of law on a country that addressed 80 to 90% of its disputes through informal means, and often struggled to understand or mitigate the cultural and social barriers to supporting women and girls. Without this background knowledge, U.S. officials often empowered power brokers who preyed on the population, or they diverted U.S. assistance away from its intended recipients to enrich and empower themselves and their allies. Like I said before, corrupt government officials stealing, you know, these funds. Lack of knowledge at the local level meant projects intended to mitigate conflict often exacerbated it and even inadvertently funded the insurgents. Oh, that's great. Okay, Rick, number seven.
Lesson seven concerning monitoring and evaluation. U.S. government agencies rarely conducted sufficient monitoring and evaluation to understand the impact of their efforts. Monitoring and evaluation, MNE, is the process of determining what works, what does not, and what needs to change as a result. Conceptually, MNE is relatively straightforward, but in practice is extremely challenging. This is especially true in complex and unpredictable environments like Afghanistan, where staff turnover is rapid. Multiple agencies must coordinate programs simultaneously. Security and access restrictions makes it hard to understand a program's challenges and impact, and myriad of variables compete to influence outcomes. The absence of periodic reality checks created the risk of doing the wrong thing perfectly. Wow. The absence of periodic reality checks created the risk of doing the wrong thing perfectly. A project that completed required checks would be considered successful, whether or not it had achieved or contributed to the broader, more important goals. SIGAR's extensive audit work on sectors spanning health, education, rule of law, women's rights, infrastructure, security assistance, and others collectively paints a picture of U.S. agencies struggling to effectively measure results while sometimes relying on shaky data to make claims of success. The U.S. government's MNE efforts in Afghanistan have been underemphasized and understaffed because the overall campaign focused on doing as much as possible, as quickly as possible, rather than ensuring programs were designed well to begin with and could adapt as needed. As a result, the U.S. government missed many opportunities to identify critical flaws in its interventions or to act on those that were identified. These shortcomings endangered the lives of the U.S., Afghan, and coalition government personnel and civilians and undermined progress towards strategic goals. David.
Wow. There's a lot there. And
yep.
I think that it'd be useful for those that are interested in really analyzing this. As I said earlier, go to the IG's website, which is SIGAR.mil, SIGAR.mil, and you can read all about the its work and download all its various reports over the last 13 or so years since it was created in 2008. And keep in mind, when it was created in 2008, the Afghan War had already been going on for 7 years, and they had a lot to sort of unravel as far as analyzing what had happened, and they've tried to stay on top of it since. All right, what are some conclusions that the IG report presents? According to the report, there are critical questions about the U.S. government's ability to carry out reconstruction efforts on the scale seen in Afghanistan. Quoting from the report, as an inspector general's office charged with overseeing reconstruction spending in Afghanistan, the IG's approach has generally been technical. They identify specific problems and offer specific solutions. However, after 13 years of oversight, the cumulative list of systemic challenges and other oversight that SIGAR and other oversight bodies have identified is staggering. As former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley told SIGAR, quote, we just don't have a post-conflict stabilization model that works. Every time we have one of these things, it is a pickup game. I don't have confidence that if we did it again, we would do it any better, unquote. According to the IG's report, quote, this was equally apparent after the Vietnam War, when a war-weary and divided country had little appetite to engage in another similar conflict. After Vietnam, for example, the U.S. Army disbanded most active duty civil affairs units and reduced the number of foreign area officers, the Army's regionally focused experts in military political operations. Special forces moved away from counterinsurgency and instead focused on conducting small-scale operations in support of conventional forces. And USAID's global staff was gradually cut by 83%. In other words, according to former Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, General Jack Keane, quote, after the Vietnam War, we purged ourselves of everything that had to do with irregular warfare or insurgency, because it had to do with how we lost that war. In hindsight, that was a bad decision, unquote. After all, declining to prepare after Vietnam did not prevent the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Instead, it ensured they would become quagmires. Rather than motivating U.S. government to improve, the difficulty of these missions may instead encourage U.S. officials to move on and prepare for something new. According to Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2011, who I note was obviously in charge over some significant events in both Iraq and Afghanistan, he said, and I quote, I have noticed too much of a tendency towards what might be called next war-itis, the propensity of much of the defense establishment to be in favor of what might be needed in a future conflict. Overall, the kinds of capabilities we will most likely need in the years ahead will often resemble the kinds of capabilities we need today, unquote. As my own personal opinion, I'm not sure really how important that conclusion is. I think what they're missing is what Andrew Bacevich has raised in interviews the past week, which is the fundamental question, why are we going to Afghanistan in the manner we did anyway? Not at all disputing we need to go get bin Laden and al-Qaeda. That's, of course, we need to do that. But do we do that by invading, occupying countries, and then reconstructing them? Look what has happened in this third world country. So the IG report continues by saying, and I quote, the post-Afghanistan experience may be no different. As this report shows, there are multiple reasons to develop these capabilities and prepare for reconstruction missions in conflict-affected countries. Number one, they're very expensive. For example, all war-related costs for U.S. efforts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan over the past few decades are estimated to be $6.4 trillion. And these reconstruction missions typically go poorly. There's widespread recognition that they go poorly. The fact that they go poorly has not prevented U.S. officials from pursuing them. In other words, we don't learn things. Also, rebuilding countries that are mired in conflict is actually a continuous U.S. government endeavor, reflected by efforts in the Balkans and Haiti and smaller efforts currently underway in Mali, Burkina Faso, Somalia, Yemen, Ukraine, and elsewhere. In other words, we keep butting our nose into countries that are falling apart and somehow expecting that we can fix them. I was thinking about this the other day, Rick. I was thinking, you know, what if in 1863, in the middle of the Civil War between the North and the South of the United States, France had decided to essentially invade and try to settle everything for us and try to impose its own system. Imagine how well that would go over, you know. And even though Afghanistan was not quite in the same type of civil war, but it did have a history of civil war and tremendous tribal conflict. It wasn't really a unified country, even though it had one name. It was a nation of tribes and a long history of conflict. Go ahead, Rick.
Therein lies a huge problem. It's a country of tribes.
Yeah.
And how we ever thought we could bring all those tribes together at the same table and come up with a unified way of running things is beyond, you know, it's impossible.
Yeah. 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 And another point that the IGU made is that these large reconstruction campaigns, in other words, 20 years in Afghanistan, they usually start small. So the point being, it's not going to be surprising if the U.S. government continues to slip into this pattern. We get in small operations and find ourselves, you know, in it year after year after year with the same lessons that we haven't learned, instead of thinking from the beginning, should we even be getting involved in this manner at all? We should be rethinking things.
You know, I had, over the weekend, I had one of our clients was in town from San Antonio because he had to see our psychologist, Dr. Gold, in Ocala for his PTSD exam. And I had a couple of other people over just to meet him and, you know, just have a little barbecue. And in any event, they were mostly Afghanistan veterans. And, you know, I posed the question, so what do you all think? And across the board, they all said, we should have gotten out a long time ago. I mean, you know, most of them had been there back in 2012, 2014, and they all said, you know, the writing was on the wall that we should have been out of there, you know, long, long time ago than we actually did. So, you know, our own soldiers saw it. They knew it was pointless, but we just kept spinning the wheel.
Well, there's so many layers that we could discuss about problems in Afghanistan, and that's not to show any disrespect to the individual soldier, Marine, airman, sailor that served over there. That's not to show disrespect towards them, and certainly have great sympathy for families that have lost a loved one in the war, and certainly have great sympathy for veterans whose lives have been altered from answering their nation's call and serve over there. That's not really what the question is at this point. In fact, I would turn that into let's get a better appreciation for all the suffering that's going on and say we need to make a smarter effort to avoid that in the future by not getting involved in these type of wars. Again, that's not in any way to suggest that we should not have gone after bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Absolutely we should have, but we should have done it in a different way, that a smarter way, instead of invading a country and then deciding that we now had to rebuild it and occupy it indefinitely. You know, there was, let's go back to February and March of 1991 for a second. We had just won a six-week war and kicked Iraq out of Kuwait. Now, yes, we'd had like about a seven-month buildup in Operation Desert Shield, but Operation Desert Storm lasted about a little more than 6 weeks. And then President George H.W. Bush and others, which ironically included General Colin Powell, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that point, they said, we're going to draw a line. We're going to get out. We're not going to continue into Baghdad. We're not going to get involved in nation building. We're not going to take down the Iraq government. We accomplished our specific mission, which was we kicked Iraq out of Kuwait, end of story, and we're going to go back home. Now, we didn't entirely go back home, but the point was they specifically realized the mess they would have gotten into, which, in fact, we did get into 12 years later in 2003 when George W. Bush invaded Iraq. But the point is, you know, ironically, as Colin Powell used to say back in the 90s, it's the Pottery Barn rule. If you go into Pottery Barn and you drop something, you break it, you own it, you pay for it, right? Well, his analogy to the military was, you invade a country, you break a country, you own it. In other words, you're responsible for it. And that's what we did to Afghanistan, except I would say we broke a country that was already completely broken. It was a completely mess. It was a third world country of people that didn't want to be Western, don't want to be Western, and despise Westerners for the most part. Obviously, some exceptions that want to move here, but the point is, we were completely ignorant and in our sort of arrogance, Western arrogance, thinking that we'd go in there and just completely fix things, and they'll be just like us, and then we'll leave, and they'll be happy. Didn't work that way, and I hope people put some serious thought into this, because if they don't learn the lessons of this, keep in mind how quickly history will repeat itself, and it could be even worse. So anyway, we've covered a lot here.
Another lesson that has to be played out here, and talk. We don't have time to talk about it, but you know, the role of Congress. You know, Congress could have stepped up, and they didn't do it. You know
why they didn't do it, Rick? If I could just offer one theory, it's because we don't have the draft. If we had the draft like we did in Vietnam, there'd be people protesting on the street because they would not want to send their kids over. But now we have a professional military. If members of Congress had to send their kids over there, it'd be a completely different story. But that has to be addressed, and also essentially the military-industrial complex. Companies that have made billions and billions of dollars off of this. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, Rick.
No, those are good points. I mean, and if Congress had to go home during their breaks and listen to their constituents knocking on their door saying, listen, like you just said, end this thing, because I don't want my kid going over there. But they didn't have that. They have to deal with that. And as a result, we had veterans going back 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times and more.
Right.
And David, you and I see it all the time. We now represent so many of these veterans of Afghanistan who are suffering from so many disabilities, and both physical and mental, that they'll have for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. So. Plus the families that lost, that had one of their family members killed. I mean, those are, it's people that are quickly forgotten. I've invited, members of the Gold Star Moms to be on our show. Hopefully, we'll have some on our show soon. But they're quickly forgotten, and they have to live the rest of their lives having suffered the loss of a family member for a war like this. How do you imagine how they're feeling about this time, so.
Yeah.
Okay, Rick, well, we're about out of time. If you want to
let's close this out here. Again, if you want more information, check out the website for the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Its website is sigar.mil. That's S-I-G-A-A-R. I'm sorry, SIGAR.MIL. And I'd like to remind everybody about our Coaching in the Care program that's offered by the VA. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching in the Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. That number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching in the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, it's time for us to go for this evening. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio, Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Corey and Hurley Law Group, and thank our producer, BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of our show. Until then, stay safe and stay healthy, and hope you have a great week.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.